welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. My guest today is Sophia Smallstorm. Sophia returns to the show to offer her insights into the dark and sinister world of what she refers to as the club, and how this malevolent and occult society is behind the desecration of humanity. Tonight's discussion will be based on two of Sophia's recent newsletters, the October newsletter, where she shares her views on the club and its pervasive influence, and the November newsletter, where she shares her thoughts on the John Podesta email leaks and the Comet Ping Pong scandal, which some researchers believe have exposed an elite pedophile ring operating in the Washington, D.C. area. Sophia is a researcher and documentary filmmaker. She is best known for her documentaries on Unraveling Sandy Hook and 9/11 Mysteries. She is also recognized for her research regarding geoengineering and synthetic biology. Sophia's newsletters are subscriber-based. Her website is sophiasmallstorm.com. Sophia, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Tim. Thank you very much for inviting me back.
Well, you're welcome, and thank you for coming back on the show. So your couple of newsletters I found particularly interesting. Also, I listened to a few of your interviews, and you offered this idea of the club, sort of a, I guess you could say, what you call not a secret society, but a sacred society that has pervasive influence. What is the club? What's your take on this?
All right. So the term the club is a generic term that I have coined, you could say, for a very vast and deep network of people that wind up and down all our societal levels. Who are in the club could be your next door neighbor. They could be the president of the United States. They could be more powerful even than presidents and people in politics. They could be CEOs of absolutely giant, you know, international corporations. They could be in the religious organizations of our world. But I now believe, after watching some videos by a guy in Wisconsin called Dave Begotka, Begotka, on YouTube. He was a very, you know, ordinary young man who opened a bar in his town. He comes from Manitowoc County in Wisconsin, and he opened a bar, and this is a fairly, you know, a interesting ambition for somebody who was barely 20, but he was doing it. And he would be visited on a regular basis by these guys, these businessmen and people, teachers from the high school, and they would keep inviting him to join the good old boys club. And this was actually the Eagles Club in town. You know how we have Masonic lodges and Elks lodges, and we've got Kiwanis, Rotary Club, Knights of Malta, these kinds of things that I always thought were hangouts for retired people, places where you played bingo and you smoked a few pipes and cigars and you just, you know, reminisced about old times. But apparently they're not. These are doorways into business networking on the most, superficial level. But then they become much deeper and darker the deeper you are inducted into these organizations, which is apparently based on selectivity. Not everybody is invited into the bowels of the Elks Lodge. But in order to become a member at all, in any of these organizations, they're fraternal orders. You have to take some kind of oath. There's always a Bible, an altar, pledge to remain absolutely mum about what goes on behind closed doors. There's a priest present, and one has to be of a certain sound mind and moral character in order to be invited to join. And I was surprised when I was researching these clubs that the people who, for instance, in Dave Begotka's town, it was the Eagles Club. And the Fraternal Order of Eagles was founded in 1898. In Seattle. And members of the Fraternal Order of Eagles throughout history have been people like Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin Roosevelt, Harry Truman, John Kennedy, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, J. Edgar Hoover, Walter Mondale, Earl Warren, Father Edward Flanagan, who founded Boys Town, Billy Ray Cyrus, Jimmy Durante, Bob Hope, Arnold Palmer, and even Art Rooney of the Pittsburgh Steelers. So, you know, I was thinking to myself, well, that's a lot of influence. And one thing that these orders, these fraternal orders, brag about is their generosity to children's programs. I think it was the Elks Club that gave $80 million, perhaps it was in 1 year, to charitable children's organizations involving athletics, you know, handicapped, making braces, hospitals, everywhere children are, these people are gravitating and giving, giving, giving. And anyway, so this club thing, you know, we talk about in our parlance in this alternative research, we talk about conspiracies and secret societies, but I stumbled in my research across the term sacred society, and I think that's the real nature of these clubs. They conduct sacred rites, rituals, and activities, and on the deep levels, in the deep basements where they consort with Satan and all this stuff that not every member even knows about but has heard rumors about, there is real darkness going on, which incorporates and includes what I think people call magic with a K and is satanic and very different from what the average citizen in, you know, Averageville, USA could even imagine or dream of.
So yeah, these clubs, which you described that they as having, well, being designed along Freemasonic lines or you know, rituals, rings within rings, multiple levels, depths you can go into, or however you want to phrase it. But they're also posing as charitable, benevolent organizations. So, and they also include membership among, you know, the whether it's local elite, prominent businessmen, politicians. These are the type of organizations that you'd want to join if you want to get ahead, like you said, networking. So that's the background of these organizations. Now, in your newsletter, you do get into the story of this Mr. Bogotka, is his name?
Yeah, Dave Bogotka.
Bogotka. And he's offered membership into one of these clubs after he witnesses an assault on a woman on the lake there. Is it Lake Michigan?
Yes.
Yeah.
In fact, this is a very famous rape case involving a man called Stephen Avery, which was circling the internet. Stephen Avery was charged with the rape of one of the local women from Dave's town. And Stephen Avery was apparently not guilty of this, yet he was incarcerated and served quite a number of years before advances in DNA proved him innocent. And so what Dave witnessed on the shoreline of the lake that I guess is right there in Manitowoc County, one of the Great Lakes, Michigan, he witnessed a woman running with, you know, half naked down the beach with blood all over her and screaming. And the police were already summoned because her husband had said she had gone jogging and she hadn't returned and she was missing. So Dave bolted into the sand dunes to see what was in there because that's where she had come out from. And he saw, much to his shock, all these businessmen from the town hiding in the bushes. And they had regular clothes on. These were not policemen. He had seen a lot of cars at the site earlier when he was riding his jet ski and he didn't quite know why, but he also saw someone who was picking stuff up out of the sand, and he realized that that was an individual. Later he realized who greatly resembled the person charged with this crime and that may have been the true rapist. And so this was a spectator event for the club, the you know, spectacle of Mrs. Bjørnsten, I think her name was, being raped. And afterwards, somebody else was charged with this crime, forced to do time in prison, and then exonerated. And Avery brought a $38 million lawsuit against the county, the sheriffs, because of the false charge and the incarceration. And right as he was filing that lawsuit, that's when they suddenly charged him with another crime. And this was the murder of a woman called Teresa Hallback, a reporter. And he and his nephew are now doing a life sentence each for this. And it turns out when you investigate this all that you can about Stephen Avery, that this appears to be another false charge. But this is the power of the club. They just don't want to accuse one of their own, and they will victimize innocent people for their own crimes. And they control the police and the courts and politics and media and you name it. They've got members there.
Now, the Steve Avery, he is the subject of popular show, Making of a Murder.
That's right. Netflix, it's on Netflix, but there was a documentary made. I don't know how closely it follows this case, but he was the subject of The Making of a Murderer. I guess to convince us that, yeah, he went from rape to murder. But the fact is there were so many people, I think some like 500,000 people who signed a petition to free Stephen Avery and acquit him of these charges. But, you know, what struck me, Tim, was that this club thing exists everywhere. And what was happening to Dave after he witnessed these events on the shore of the lake, when he opened his bar, he kept getting these visits from these older men. And, you know, they showed him photos of themselves, I imagine. They showed him photos of naked men doing stuff, sexual stuff to one another. And they said, you have to join the club. Don't you want to look at these pictures? And he said, no, I don't want to join this club. And over, they would pay him visits at his bar and they would get very, very insistent. They would yell at him. They would tell him, you better join the club, Dave, or else something is going to happen. And the something that happened was the tragic murder of his manager, Marianne. He had also been receiving information from Marianne that while she was managing the bar, the same men would come in and they would say, you better get Dave to join the good old boys club, which was the Eagles club. And she said, well, he doesn't want to. And she told him, you know, they're insisting you join, Dave. I don't know why, but you need to know. They're getting ugly about it. And the next thing that happened was Dave Bogatka went on a hunting trip for 10 days, and this was before cell phones. And when he returned, his mother told him, you know, Marianne died right after you left. She was found dead of a heart attack was the cause, covered with blood in her bed. And what had happened in his absence while he was on the hunting trip was that there was a giant party at his club, and all the booze was given away. Sorry, at his bar, there was a giant party. All the booze was given away. Equipment was ripped out and, I guess, you know, taken by people. And there was just a shell of a place left, and he had to declare bankruptcy, to say nothing of the murder of his manager or the death. And so this is the power of the club.
So I guess a message was sent today that if you resist our blandishments, our offers, it's a deal you have to take. A deal you can't turn down, you know, an offer you can't refuse, as the Godfather might say. And so his manager is found dead. They say it's a heart attack, natural causes, yet there's blood on her.
Yeah, she was covered with blood lying in her own bed, and they deemed the cause of death to be a heart attack.
There's one thing in the newsletter, I think, where Marianne is telling Dave, more or less, she spells it out to him, because he says offers what to go to the authorities, and she says something to him, how futile that is.
Yeah. She had been telling him, these guys keep coming in, and they keep saying, you need to join, you need to join, you need to join the club. And from Dave's blog, it says here, On the last day Dave spoke to Marianne in person, she said she was sleeping with a gun because she was so fearful of these people, meaning the people who were constantly coming to the bar. Dave suggested going to the police, to which Marianne responded, "They are the police."
So he's more or less driven out of business, and you know he won't ever become a prominent business member of the community without joining the club. I guess that's the message we get from that. And to join the club, you have to be brought in and partake in their rituals or their whatever they do in secret or in the basement somewhere. And I guess that's. Well, one thing that's interesting, what you're describing is what similar things we've heard about Skull and Bones and various other secret societies. This idea of clubs in various cities and locales. This is reminiscent of the lodge system of Freemasonry, and how societal or global control is maintained through the lodge system, whether it's intelligence or just being able to suborn or infiltrate. Insinuate themselves at multiple levels of society, while the facade of normalcy is maintained. That's one thing that's most chilling about this. It seems to be a strategy that they seem to follow throughout the ages. Would you agree?
Right. They can include people who would then end up protecting them because of the benefits that come with club membership, which is for those who are, ordinary, just good business contacts and the opportunity to network and profit and be more successful.
Mm-hmm.
And then for those who are inclined to other kinds of activities, there's Satanism, there's pedophilia, there's I don't know what else. I mean, it's just now we're learning that this trafficking and whatnot goes on in all the cities of the world. There are always these rings that are discovered and busted. And apparently the enjoyment of children and children's energy in a sexual way and a sacrificial way is something that these people do. And that, you see, Tim, we were talking before the show, that is the stuff of ordinary people's nightmares. This is not what ordinary people fantasize about during the day as they go about their business. Ordinary people protect their children. They have tightly knit nuclear families with the best interests of all the members in mind. They don't exploit their children. And what I'm learning now, much to my horror, is that a lot of the children involved in human trafficking and pedophilia and sacrifice, which is murder. It's, very ugly, gruesome, grisly murder of these children. It's often on film. And then those films are sold in the black market to people who pay lots of money to watch them. And these children are bred for this industry. They're actually made by mothers who are either Satanists or participants, pedophiles, traffickers themselves. I read on Henry Macca's website, and I wrote to him to ask where this little bit was, because I remember copying it with my mouse, and I was going to send it to myself, and I forgot to do that. But it was on one of his posts, and it said that the prostitutes of Washington, D.C. often conceive babies, and they, of course, the fathers are the high-level elite politicians and so forth, and they first hit up the fathers for support, and then they donate these babies and toddlers and children to the pedophilia industry. Awful.
Well, again, it seems crazy. It seems hard to believe, but we do live in a country that tolerates, a 1.5 million abortions a year. I think globally it's about 50 million. And within that industry is also the selling of fetal remains or baby parts by Planned Parenthood. And so it's not too far of a stretch, at least in my estimation of things, to think that something like this can be going on, because it's just an extension of the same philosophy. It's something that's hard for most people to accept is going on. But if the authorities are compromised or controlled or in on it, who's going to investigate it? Who do you go to? As Marianne said, they are the police. You know?
That's right. And they have power to destroy you physically. They can take your life. They can arrange for an ugly accident, which is very peculiar. You know how many people die in car crashes, plane crashes, heart attacks, this, that, and the other thing?
Yeah.
It's the same type of death. And so if you get in their way or you start drawing attention to what they're doing, I guess you're invited to join at some point, maybe. And if you're not and you start to expose them, then you're eliminated. And or your children, your loved ones can be hurt. And these are messages to you that take note of the power we have, and we will do something to you if you get in our way. And yeah, they are the police, they are the authorities.
And a representation, at least an illustration of this, that we can point to, because we're engaging in, you know, I guess you could say informed speculation, because we don't have the benefit of, you know, we don't have subpoena power, we can't issue warrants, we can't go in and demand that we investigate these, but you have to rely on these authorities, which, in our opinion, are compromised, is how the intelligence agencies operate. They have expertise in, you know, in all types of, dark arts, you know, whether you had to arrange for someone's accidental death, how to suicide people if necessary. They have manuals, that train people how to do this to make things look like accidents. They can get planes to blow up, even with collateral to innocent other people involved in it, to make it look like an accident. That's been done before. So we can look at some of these clubs or sacred societies or secret societies as being somewhat like the very intelligence services throughout the world. And in fact, I think they're linked in many respects, because place outfits like Skull and Bones at Yale University, they kind of formed the nucleus of our own intelligence services, the OSS and CIA. And so it's an operating manual or operating stratagem, so to speak, and how you kind of control society, or at least be able to manipulate society and maintain control of it. You mentioned that this one club, this Fraternal Order of Eagles, was founded, and it's sort of this local businessmen getting together, and they formed what they call an order of good things, more or less to forming a cartel. And if they organize themselves properly, they can more or less cartelize a given industry or monopolize a local economy. And through that control, they can pretty much decide who's successful and who's not. And you take over things like whether the local radio station, the media, the local newspaper, and just apply this strategy nationally or globally, and it works. And that's sort of what Freemasonry does. I mean, you can look at Freemasonry as a sort of technology that enables one to engage in high-level malfeasance and criminality and subversion. That's why the British Empire relied on it for so long. I mean, the British Freemasonry was central to the maintenance of the British Empire. That's through the lodge system, particularly on the European continent, but throughout the world, that's how it engaged in sort of secret communications and espionage, and also subversion of foreign societies through the Masonic lodge system, introduction of subversive ideas to undermine the local order of things. But you can also look at our own Central Intelligence Agency, which is, you could argue, is designed along Freemasonic lines. I was listening to Doug Valentine recently, and he's written a lot about the CIA as an organized crime operation. But he was talking about how the CIA will go in and undermine a foreign country and take it over. And what it does, it goes into said country, and it will infiltrate that first the governmental institutions, like the that government's intelligence agencies will be infiltrated by CIA assets, and then there's the other institutions like local police departments, local media, newspapers, TV stations, radio stations will be infiltrated by CIA assets, and even the civil societies, the civil society of foreign government, like the local Lions Club, will be infiltrated by CIA assets. So pretty soon they'll be in a position to bend that foreign country or that society to its will. And, you can say is here when you're talking about the club, I think is the club a sort of a local application of this global strategy? Is that fair?
It's a catch-all term, I would say, for people who are knitted into this global order. Mm-hmm. And they might be on very local levels and not high highly ranked or highly influential participants, but because they are in the order and they've taken vows and oaths and they're one of the brothers, it's a fraternal order. So they have an obligation. I suppose this is the morality of the club, a moral obligation not to rat on or snitch on what's going on at very high levels. And as long as they keep their mouths shut, they will prosper. They will be able to put, you know, nice toys under the Christmas tree for their children and ascend into greater wealth, bigger houses, better cars, sending kids to college who then will follow in their footsteps and become a club member. And so not every member of every club has to be a dark cloak and dagger, blood drinking pedophile, but it's those lower members that form the ranks of protection around what goes up on at the top of the pyramid. I'm just speculating, and I use this term, the club, because it's the easiest term there is.
Yeah, it's rings within rings, degrees, as in Freemasonry calls it, and they call them, I think, porch brethren, the people who are members of these organizations who may be deriving some sort of, you know, professional or business benefit from this relationship, but they're there to provide sort of this, I guess, the outer, the facade, and they're there to maybe to dispense charity, and they're not really aware of certain things. And from what I understand is, you can be invited into a higher circle, and if you you know, demur, they don't penalize you. You just don't go any higher anymore. And this is how they separate those who are willing to do things, you know, to do some of these things that are necessary to rise through the ranks, and those who aren't. But nevertheless, people maintain their membership. From what I understand, the Council on Foreign Relations is very much the same way, and so is, you know, the CIA, and I would imagine any other intelligence service throughout the world, where it's highly compartmentalized. It's need to know. And very few people are aware of the whole picture, yet they're part of the machine. They're helping it operate. And as you say, people who – there's some benefits to belonging to it, and also some benefits to not making waves or making sure you don't ask you know, inconvenient questions or problematic questions, and you just serve the system. You become sort of an organization man, is what the system relies on, sort of the participation of the system. And everyone's allowed to get their beak wet a little bit, so they perceive some benefit, but they're not aware of the overall damage that's created by the system itself. You know?
Right. I was listening to YouTube. Maybe it wasn't even YouTube. I don't know. It was Jim Fetzer interviewing Jim Rothstein, who is a former New York City detective. And I have put this on my blog. People can go to sophiasmallstorm.com and scroll down, and you'll find the Dave Bigotka interviews there. That's under the title Joining the Club. And then you'll find this Rothstein interview. So Detective Rothstein, who's retired, he explains that back in the 1970s, actually the late 60s, he started to investigate pedophilia and prostitution in New York City. And he says that what ordinary people think is pedophilia and prostitution is such a diluted version of what's really going on. He said, we have no idea. And what goes on is beyond our imagination. So I'm just going to read a little quote that I excerpted from the video, from the interview. So this is Rothstein talking to Jim Fetzer. Not only did I get assigned to this, meaning the investigation of prostitution and pedophilia, I was given an unlimited expense account. We didn't just work on police aspects. We also went into the psychological. We found out many, many things that were never known before. Many of these people, meaning the perpetrators, were victims themselves and became pedophiles. And then we have others who, when they reached a certain level of power, this was the next step to it, where they felt they could do anything they wanted to. And a big thing, too, is many of these people are set up to be compromised. One time, there were three houses of prostitution in New York being used to compromise people. The only problem was I had an informant in every one. The informant told me about a pedophile operation, and the particular night on East 64th Street, they killed two little boys, two 14-year-olds and a 15-year-old, while they were having sex with them. And eventually, I served a subpoena on the people, meaning the individuals participating in this horrible stuff. And it was covered up under the pretext of national security. And Rothstein says, I personally identified the man and personally served him with a subpoena in Locust Valley, New York, at the coffee shop by the railroad station. And before we could get back to the office, it was shut down.
Yeah. And that's what you call the domino effect in your newsletter.
Yes, that's another term of mine. And what I mean by that is that this power goes up the chain and down the chain. So as you head higher, toward higher levels of power, certain activities are offered as par for the course. And so indulging in these activities becomes the norm. I mean, if you are someone who wants to be the local district attorney, right, and you're climbing through the ranks of office, and then you're offered something like this, and you're told, well, you know, wink, wink, everybody does it. Don't worry about it. You want to get to be DA, you're going to have to do this too. Otherwise, you can just stay right where you are. So I guess there's this power in this concept of brotherhood. We're all part of a brotherhood and whatever. They get these people drunk and they get them to have sex with children or do something that they probably wouldn't do otherwise. Certainly not at home with their wives, and that's it. And then they're in it, and they probably continue to do it. And there's photos and film of them doing it. And then if any of this is investigated, from high up comes that shutdown. So that's the domino effect going down the chain.
Yes, and a couple of cases would seem to back up that your analysis there. Would be, well, one thing is the Finders case that was exposed of a child trafficking ring that was, I think, exposed in Florida, but it led up here to Washington, D.C., and an office, a warehouse that was equipped with, you know, not only with a lot of satanic ritual paraphernalia and other things, but also at the time state-of-the-art communication systems and things like that. So I think just the late 80s, early 90s. And that investigation was quashed in the name of national security, which means it's probably a blackmail operation or some sort of operation that's feeding children to foreign dignitaries, businessmen, and such. And I think you're more than familiar with the Franklin scandal and how that also involved Washington D.C. call boy, human child trafficking, and also. Blackmail operation here in Washington, D.C. that was run by one Craig Spence, another D.C. lobbyist. Or this one, he was a GOP lobbyist. But that he had parties at his house that was wired for audiovisual. And that appeared to be a blackmail operation. I think Deborah Jean Palfrey, her call girl operation, was being monitored by the FBI and, according to some research, is being used by the FBI for blackmail operations, and she didn't get in trouble until she shut her operation down. They were using it for intelligence. There's case studies here that we can, we can infer that something like this, these things occur all the time. And as Detective Rothstein said, what he investigated. Of course, I think he was also part of the Son of Sam investigation in the 70s. I think that's still an open case, although it's cold. But I think it wasn't just a slow nut. I think that people who've done research on that, like the book The Ultimate Evil, Maury Terry's book, is that it had something to do with satanic rituals, Untermyer Park, and murders out in out in California and South Dakota, and it also led back to some sort of what they thought was a snuff film operation, and that's where it is now. I think that it was a larger operation. Victims were being shot under streetlights, and the idea was they needed streetlights because someone was filming the operations. And so, I mean, there's a lot of. Like I said, there's a lot of these cases suggest that that's what's going on here. It's all part of a real sordid industry and also intelligence. I think FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds has written about this as well, about how she was talking to an FBI agent who was doing background checks on, I think, on judicial appointees, and she said that he told her that when they find dirt on somebody, the person who has dirt on him gets promoted. The person who's clean doesn't. because it's hard to, how do you do business with an honest man? Yeah. So there's a strategy here. You know, it's almost like a plan to this type of operation.
Now, Tim, I'm going to draw attention to something. You've given us a lot of indicators that something is going on. I was just watching a YouTube of a young girl who was a ritual abuse victim in her own home in England, and she has fled, and she's being safeguarded somewhere here in America. But she points out that when she tried to go to CPS, Child Protective Services, they didn't believe her. And it took a tremendous amount of effort, weeks and weeks. She was shuttled around in all kinds of foster care situations, and she finally managed to get to the United States, I'm not sure how, and ask for asylum. And so the point is that CPS did not believe what she had to tell them. Yet, CPS is the agency which, under the doctrine of parens patriae, which is a legal doctrine that gives the state power over any and all children, we have a new bill pending in California. It's following on the heels of SB 277, which is the mandatory vaccines. This one is called SB 18. It's engineered by the same Richard Pan. He's apparently a senator. And it's called Pan's new bill for California, the Children's Rights Bill. So the state will define and demand what's appropriate in terms of care, education, nourishment, nutrition for any and every child. So the California legislature is declaring that all children and youth have inherent rights. They have the right to parents, guardians, and caregivers who act in their best interest, the right to form healthy attachments with proper adults for proper care and well-being, the right to live in a safe and healthy environment, the right to social and emotional well-being, et cetera, et cetera. And this Bill of Rights, Children's Bill of Rights, is going to give the agencies, the state agencies, the opportunity to come in and assess the child's home and the environment in which a child is being raised and declare it unfit. And this, what surprises me, although it's no surprise, is that in the case of this poor little British girl, she was definitely having horror stories to tell about her parents with probably ample proof. And CPS didn't do anything for her and didn't want to. They kept returning her to her parents initially. And now we've got CPS that's going to come in America and remove children for the flimsiest reasons based on their own standards, government set standards. And that will enable those children to be sent into foster care. And what I have found out now in my dabblings and just learning as we do is that many instances of foster care are far below what you would want for somebody, for a child. These parents, these foster parents are reckless, they are criminal or near criminal in many instances, and yet the children are placed in their care. Now, they do get a certain amount of money from the government for this care that they give to these foster children, but what I found to be very interesting is that the state receives a giant federal bonus for placing children in foster care. And in a given state, it might be $4,000 for every child that they remove from their natural home and natural parents and place in foster care. But when they remove a special needs child and they put that child in foster care, they get double or certainly a significantly higher amount. So these are called adoption incentive bonuses. And so it becomes in the state's interest, because it's going to profit, to displace children, dislocate them from their natural parents and locate them into foster care, because the children are now commoditized. And when you place children who are minors, and especially if they're special needs children, autistic or handicapped in some way, and they can't express what's happening to them, and you place them in the care of people who are, you know, not appropriate, meaning I'll just use the word near criminal or criminal, then you get the perfect setup for those children to be trafficked out to elites who are pedophiles who will pay plenty of money for these activities with these poor children. And as long as the children survive this torture, they make tons of money. They're potentially worth tens of thousands of dollars.
That reminds me of the what you just said there, the case of Georgia State Senator Nancy Schaefer, who was very critical of her state's Child Protective Services. She was killed in a murder-suicide, allegedly. And, all her friends and family said they were a very happy couple. They had suffered some financial reverses because of the housing market, but nothing that would have made them think that a husband would kill her then and kill himself. But she was pointing out that CPS case officers in her state were paid cash bonuses of $4,000, $6,000 for each child that was removed from a family and adopted, put in the foster care, then subsequently adopted. And she, I think her report was the corrupt business of the CPS. And she was pointing out that kids were literally being kidnapped from families of, under the most, ridiculous pretext being sold off, more or less. And this all derives from a federal program. I think it was the Adoption and Safe Families Act of 1974, which is then amended and expanded by Bill Clinton in the late 90s. So, yeah, like you said, these agencies and agents are given cash bonuses for removing children from families.
These are actually contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Everything operates in contract and commerce form. So these agencies are commercial entities, and they look to create contracts and receive payments accordingly for the activities that they exist to do. And so if they exist to protect children on the face of whatever that means, then they'll make money if they go around and remove children from their natural parents and place them with other people, because all they do is operate on contracts, commerce and contracts. So they have a contract. This cash bonus is actually a contract from the federal government to do this. And the federal government just borrows money ad infinitum, and the debt grows and grows, and that money is funneled down the pike to people who are willing to build the country and create it in the vision of this police state, New World Order, exploitive, harmful, ruinous society.
And again, what's going on here is we have you mentioned earlier that how the club operates. They infiltrate, take over. They make sure that people within the club are promoted, and they become school principals. They become directors of agencies, perhaps director of Child Protective Services, right? And once you get into these, once you infiltrate the bureaucracies of the various state agencies, you can, again, make sure that although Child Protective Services is there to ostensibly protect children, you can almost twist it around and make an agency for harming children under the color of law and under the majesty of the state. And that's the ultimate position that someone, if you were had malevolent intentions and ambitions, that's where you'd want to be. And it appears that Child Protective Services, as the public schools, as the police, as the courts, have been suborned in many ways, in many instances. And those who investigate these things tend usually don't turn out too well. They end up dying or committing suicide or being murdered or dying in car accidents. If you recall the Franken scandals, the investigator for John DeCamp, who was spearheading the Nebraska State Legislature investigation, he claimed to have the goods on them, photographs and such. He'd gotten the stuff in Chicago and had flown up there under the pretext of going to the Major League All-Star Game. I think it was 1989, and he had his own plane, so he flew up there with his son, and he talked to John DeCamp and said, "We got him. We have these photographs." More or less the smoking gun seems always missing in these cases. And his plane disintegrated in midair, along killing him and his son. And his briefcase was never found.
that was supposedly carrying the damaging information. And that's what happens to these people, you know, if you get too close.
That's right, but passports can fall out of planes hitting buildings in New York and survive those explosions and crashes, right?
Well, if it supports the official narrative, yes. So, it's one of these things where it goes back to your idea. That's why I think that October newsletter was so insightful, because it gives us a – although you're speculating, but you're basing it on your understanding of you know, how these other secret societies operate, how organized crime, how the mafia operates, is through a system of networking and various levels, you can effectively take over a society and make sure that you can engage in these things at a high level and with great frequency and with a high degree of confidence that you're operating with immunity. And if you can operate with immunity, you can kill with impunity. Who's to stop you? You know.
So, Tim, what's interesting to me is that these activities can be comfortably pursued as long as people are assembled and incentivized, which means money usually, to form the blocking panels on the lower level against prying eyes, right? So they can pay contracts, and the people who go to work for Child Protective Services, by the way, in Schaefer's research, she found that an enormous number of the child CPS agents were dubious in terms of moral character themselves. So it's like one big old club again. But on these lower levels and mid levels, money is used as incentive and reward. But I am wondering, okay, so on the very high levels where they actually drink the adrenalized blood of tortured victims, many of whom are children, and they engage in human sacrifice and, you know, indescribable sex acts with children, including babies, what they're really getting out of this. And that is, it's not something I want to spend all my time wondering about, but this is where they split from the average person.
Yeah, because most people understand the principle of follow the money, and that's sort of economic determinism. But that works. I think that works for the general society in keeping people in line. But you're right, at this elite's level, or inner circle, if you will, we'll call them elite. There's a spiritual. Sort of a metaphysical level to this that's hard to understand. I've heard the idea of them drinking blood with adrenaline in it, and if you torture an animal, in this case it's called a child, unfortunately, is an animal in their eyes, and with fear you get adrenaline, and there's some sort of high you get, from what I understand. Now, I don't know if that's you know, I've read about it. Unfortunately, I never witnessed it myself, but it is... gives us a sort of a look into the vampiric nature of these, you know, the parasitical or vampiric nature of these people, if they are indeed engaged in such things. I remember the Atlanta child murders. The kids went missing in Atlanta. This was in 1980, and I guess Wayne Williams was the fall guy for that. People who've researched that said they really couldn't have been a one-man operation there. He seems to have been a fall guy. But there's some speculation that perhaps children were being harvested for interferon, for some sort of experiment. Not that coupled with maybe a some sort of psyop in the Atlanta community area with idea of serial killers and this stuff. I think I don't know if you're familiar with the late Dave McGowan's research regarding serial killers, how one element of it might have been a psyop designed to sort of terrorize the nation to further the sort of strategy of tension, if you will, to bring it further promote a police state mentality, to atomize society, to keep stifle the formation of communities. Kids don't go out and play anymore. They're very protected in these things. And that's one way you can make a society more atomized and more, more easily managed through fear. But It's hard. Yeah, it's really. I mean, again, it's at that level. It's hard to understand because you're. I think at that point you're dealing with some sort of dark satanic ritual, and you know, I don't know necessarily if I believe it, but if they believe it and they think they're getting something out of it, at the end of the day, you still have victims. You know, children being tortured and murdered and sacrificed.
Right, and you know. This whole idea of Satanism, if you tell your next door neighbor that there's Satanists all over the place, and it might be the police chief in town, it might be, you know, somebody in a high level of government in your state, or many people, they're not going to believe you. But what I find again interesting is that the symbols of Satanism are so pervasive in our culture now. The children are buying, there are even satanic sneakers, and there's t-shirts with skulls all over them, and the satanic symbols in music videos, references in advertising, the one eye on the dollar bill. I mean, it's all over the place. So if you point to these, you know, these proofs of Satanism, and you show your next door neighbor how this relates to Satanism, then what you've got is you've got a population that on a mass level is participating in Satanism, whether they realize it or not. So you've got the very dark, very horrific activities behind closed doors whereby people must draw some kind of power or something from doing these things. That you and I don't really understand, but you've got our nephews and nieces and neighbors and our own children buying this stuff with this symbology all over it that they don't know is part of that market.
Yeah, and well, one level of Satanism has been described to me is it's not necessarily worship of a deity or entity itself, but it's self-worship. And maybe if to get people to become self-worshipping, maybe you are serving the devil or Satan. That's the old joke, was that the best trick the devil ever played was convincing people he doesn't exist. But if you look at society and self being driven towards sort of this narcissism that we see being promoted everywhere. Of course, we have TV shows like Lucifer, I think, where Satan is the protagonist. You have these, you know, a few years ago, you had, of course, this trend of teenage vampire movies, these, you know, my estimations, sort of silly romantic teenage, where the vampires are good, you know. And, of course, that's all, you know, the whole zombie craze is part of that as well, sort of degradation of society, the devaluation of human life, getting people conditioned to, you know, killing their fellow man without any concern because they've been dehumanized. But if you make a good point, if you gear society towards sort of this debt finance consumerism which is producing sort of these narcissistic individuals, that's part of what a lot of these TV shows do, whether it's the you know, Rear Housewives of New Jersey or Cutthroat Kitchen, these competitive shows that they're promoting, you know, sort of this ruthless approach towards life without any empathy. And in a sense, everyone, to the extent that people embrace that outlook on life, they have become de facto Satanists, although they may not realize it themselves.
Yeah, they're promoting competition as opposed to cooperation. And I think that the basic, qualities of human interaction are cooperative rather than competitive. And you see this in a very banal example. If you walk up to anyone just about and you say, "Do you have the time?" they will dig in their backpack or their purse or their pocket for their cell phone. They'll even turn it on if they have to tell you the time, right? In the old days, they used to flip their wrists and look at a watch. But now they actually go to a greater length to do that. I'm not sure why, but people want to help you out for a simple favor like that. Yet in our society, even in school, the whole way our society is structured, we are taught to compete with one another. And you've got to do better than this one. You have to make more money. You have to get the highest grade. You have to, you know, go to a better college than Johnny, your best friend, or something. And it's very sad. And we see this competitive drive, which they've taught us, drives us to excel. Huh? I don't think so. I think it leaves you very alone at the end of the day, at the end of your life, you know, when you have amassed a big McMansion with granite everything and three-car garage, and all your teenage kids are off in their own cars with their friends watching music videos on their phones. What do you have left? So okay, I just want to mention something because you mentioned Lucifer. Somebody drew my attention to a class of enzymes called luciferase. They're actually making these enzymes commercially available now. And these enzymes are oxidative, meaning they take up energy and express themselves as bioluminescence. Like the firefly uses an enzyme to create light. And they've actually named this enzyme luciferase. Yeah, it's pretty amazing, isn't it? And so in the last, one of the last interviews I did with Sage of Quay, it was about biological darkness. And I don't know if we want to get into that, but I do believe that the cycle of night is of great interest to these perpetrators of doom and destruction, because it's during the night that things are degraded and biodegraded and degenerated by organisms, you know, like molds and fungi. They work best at night. But these people are Lucifer worshipers. And Lucifer is the angel of light. It's the angel of the nighttime light, the light of the moon, which is qualitatively different from the light of the sun. It's a silver frequency versus a golden frequency. And it, as a friend of mine said, it's the frequency that calls out the coyotes, the vampires, the moles. And it's the frequency that makes everything fall apart, which is part really of the natural cycle, because that degeneration gets turned into nutrients for the organisms that thrive in the light of the sun. But these perpetrators, as agents of Lucifer and worshippers of Lucifer, this is the light they worship. They worship the light of darkness, the light that comes out at night. Do you see what I'm saying? Because everything they do is at night. They have their nighttime rituals. They dress in black. So all their destruction is this. It's oxidation. In biology, oxidation means loss of energy.
Yeah, and of course, yeah, that's sort of, is the oxidative stress, which causes so many human ailments. That seems that's a whole other topic. But how all the stressors that we're subjected to, our biology is subjected to with modern life, tends towards poor health, and of course supporting the medical industrial complex, which seems to be a whole other part of their business plan. I listened to your talks regarding biology, you know, the darkness versus light and sunlight versus moonlight, and how they serve two different purposes. One promotes life, one breaks it down. And obviously, if you're promoting darkness, you're all the time, you're going to cause, you know, without the rejuvenation, you're just going to get a breakdown. But this leads us into this your November newsletter, where you focused on the Podesta emails and this Pizzagate scandal, which seems to have revealed what many people believe reveals or exposes a pedophile ring operating in Washington, D.C. Now, I think you've talked a lot about the details of it. I think we're familiar with the emails, the strange wording, which make no sense literally, but they do make sense if you understand some of these words, hot dogs, pizza, as code words for pedophilia, which I think the FBI recognizes as code words for pedophilia. And the strange love that this Comet Ping Pong operation run by Mr. Elefantis has, or interest it has, with children, you know, which is odd. But in your talk, and also in the newsletter, you talk about this, the issue of pedophilia and how there's been a trend to normalize pedophilia, which is very similar to the efforts of the 70s, 80s, and 90s to normalize homosexuality. Do you want to get into that?
Yes, it's very pervasive, and they're going to keep repeating it and repeating it and repeating it, just the way they did with the gay movement. There is a writer, Margot Kaplan. She's actually a Rutgers University law professor, and she wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times. The date is October 5th, 2014. And Margot, you can Google it, M-A-R-G-O-K-A-P-L-A-N. So she states in this op-ed piece that people actually live with pedophilia. They have a shame about it. It's simply a sexual attraction to prepubescence, and that it can be viewed as a mental illness. But our laws don't serve these people properly, because when these people should, for whatever reason, commit the crime of pedophilia, at least the article seems to believe that pedophilia, once it's actually committed, is a crime. That's when the agencies come after these victims of this mental illness and punish them, but that there should be recognition of the fact that there are many people who are pedophiles. Now, I'm quoting Margot Kaplan, who never do anything. They never act on their impulses. And so there's an organization, Virtuous Pedophiles, and this organization provides support for pedophiles who don't molest children and who even believe that sex with children is wrong. So these would be inactive or non-practicing pedophiles, and that pedophile is a status. Pedophilia is a status. It's not an act. So when you get to the point that it's an act, you know, then you've crossed the line. And so I think what she's trying to advocate is that we should have sympathy for pedophiles, and we should allow them to be appropriately employed. This is what she calls it. We should hold them responsible for their conduct, but not for the underlying attraction that they have to live with, that dogs them and causes them to, you know, retreat and skulk around and hide. We should bring all this out into the open. So that caused me to start wondering about, well, if they've got virtuous pedophiles, an organization, they might end up with an organization called CeliPeds. Celibate pedophiles, and you might have a principal of a school who's a celibate pedophile. Don't worry, children, because he's never touched a child in 25 years. He's a good man. He's safe to be around.
Well, what we're getting in society with this normal attempt to normalize or sympathize with pedophilia, it's being being entertained in academia. There's also what we've seen, of course, in recent years, is this sexualization of children, which has occurred in entertainment, in fashion, with music, obviously, whether it's Miley Cyrus or Britney Spears a few years ago, her music video, dancing around, sexually in a plaid skirt. It looks like a Catholic schoolgirl's uniform. We, of course, in the 70s, we had this introduction of sexual education with the goal, I guess, of the stated goal of reducing teenage pregnancy. Of course, it's gone up 400% since then, as the programs have become more explicit. I think it was in the 70s when Life magazine put on the cover, teenage pregnancy, and I guess Time magazine had a cover, children having children. So all of these things seem to have sort of a revelation of the method to them, where by addressing the topic, by making it an issue that we're supposedly concerned with, that everyone's talking about, we're actually promoting it, and we actually aggravate the problem, which might be the goal of the social engineers. If you recall, with AIDS, the AIDS scare of the 80s, it became a pretext to implement very graphic sex ed courses for adolescents, school age kids. And I believe I came across this when I was reading Nancy Turner Banks's book, AIDS, Diamonds, and Empire. I think you've interviewed her, and you read that book, right?
Yes, it's a very thorough book.
Yeah, and she can. I mean, she was talking about AIDS, and of course, the problem of AIDS virus, HIV being the source of AIDS. It's a lot of controversy with that, but I don't want to get into that right now. But she was talking about, it was the 1989 National Research Council, which produced a study that was funded by the Russell Sage Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the usual suspects, U.S. Public Health Service, and it was AIDS, sexual and intravenous drug use. And I think it read something like, the epidemic necessitates the rapid mobilization of the community to counter the spread of this illness and disease. There's the fear factor there being utilized. And through this fear, they were able to implement these sex ed programs, which otherwise parents would have rejected or would have opposed. But you tell people, if the kids don't learn this stuff, they're going to contract AIDS. They'll never acquiesce to it. But in the report, it actually stated, if I can get the report, it says, what is not yet known is how to introduce fear in the right way in a particular message intended for a particular audience. Acquiring that knowledge will require planned variations of age education program that are carefully executed out and then carefully evaluated. The report went on to express how to attack societal moral values related to speaking and writing about sexuality in explicit terms. Again, they were advocating the direct attack on our children when they stated, despite recent indications of great increased tolerance of sexual explicitness in the media and literature, their reluctance remains strong in much of the population, and it is particularly strong in the instance of that education of children and adolescents. So this, you're using the crisis of... I'm sorry, can you hear me?
It just cut out briefly. I heard introducing the crisis of...
Oh, good. Okay, sorry. They're introducing the crisis of AIDS to introduce all this sexual explicitness with kids. So already you have, we're not talking about secret society stuff here. We're not talking about Skull and Bones. We're not talking about the club, nor are we talking about Freemasonry or the Elks Club or the Eagles Club or some sort of satanic, secret society. This is the U.S. Public Health Service, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Russell Sage Foundation, our public schools, intentionally sexualizing all children under the cover of a public health measure, but normalizing all this stuff with the children. This has been occurring for decades, under the guise of official policy.
Yeah, that's a very good insight, Tim. And I really haven't heard anyone put it that way. Most people, when they talk about AIDS, they talk about the fraud of HIV causing AIDS or something related more to the medical research, but you have really nailed it. Excellent. That's exactly what they did.
And one other thing is this case with Comet Ping Pong Pizza. So now we get this scandal of pedophilia that's thrown out to the public. We're kind of aware of it, but we're never really going to get an investigation of it. We're never going to get some sort of, no one's going to close the book on it. It's just going to be out there. I was talking to a couple people regarding, there's an alchemical process that goes on with this revelation of the method. I think it was, we saw this with this Clinton scandal with Monica Lewinsky, how with the Starr report, Kenneth Starr was fixated on the Lewinsky angle and ignored the MENA, Arkansas, the real stuff, with the drug dealing and what they were doing in MENA with the FBI, with the CIA and the Bushes. But by fixating on the sordid sexual details of Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky and getting into the news, everyone was talking about it, getting into the meaning of sexes, and everyone's talking about fellatio in public, and it's being debated on the news shows, and pretty soon the stuff is being talked about in front of middle school kids. And they found out that in the wake of that scandal, there was a marked increase in sexual activity, particularly that sexual activity, among middle school kids. Mission accomplished.
You see? Very interesting.
And Michael Hoffman, in his book, Secret Societies, he had an intro on this. He's talking about metal. It's sort of a revelation of the method. And then you got into this because, well, first of all, let me get you in your newsletter. If I can get to the highlights, is
is in that October newsletter, you close it out with a discussion, well, about, I can get to it in my notes here. It's about how society comes to accept this. We don't do anything. How with Comet Ping Pong Pizza, the club has signaled society that they're doing this. And in our inaction, we sort of relieve them of the karmic effect of their sordid activity and almost ratify it if we don't do anything about it, despite the fact when it's revealed to us. We're sort of setting on to it. Do you have your newsletter there? Can you read that section to us?
Yes. I'm going to read two paragraphs. Yeah. The title of this section is The Silence of the Lambs. And I say, imagine years from now how we're going to coexist with people with pedophilic disorders who have done no harm, but the neighborhood children know and are scared of those houses. Imagine the parents who will be indoctrinated to forgive in advance, be tolerant and understanding. The treatment is effective. The treatment, by the way, is chatting with an expert or taking pharma drugs, of course. What else? The treatment is effective and your kids should be safe. What the law professor's piece utterly fails to mention is that where there's smoke, there's often an additional case of fatal blazing fire in the form of satanic rituals accompanying pedophilic activities. I say pedo activities in my newsletter, in which children are abused to the point of death and or are sacrificed. Not a word of this, and I bet that if pedophilia is eventually legalized, this depraved underworld will remain completely hidden, the stuff of crazy YouTubers' imaginings only. By leaking the Podesta emails to us and watching the resulting storm grow into a typhoon, the club has sent us an invitation to respond. With its debunking of the typhoon as fake news, the sheeple will blink and go back to their daily grazing, TV, shopping, Facebook. The typhoon is the reaction of a small minority whose cries will likely be obliterated by the vast enveloping silence of the lambs. Thus the club will gain its requisite karmic permission to carry on with its secret / sacred affairs, for they did let us know, they gave it all to us, but as a collective we fail to react, object, oppose them. It's about scope, numbers, the majority versus the few.
Yeah, and then you finish it with your discussion. You're talking with a lady friend of yours regarding the Franklin cover-up, and after, I guess, going over some of the sort of details, she sort of said, well, it's not my children. I have my own children to worry about. I'll let you worry about those children.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She actually said, you can worry about other children in the world. You're good at it. You can worry for me. I remember this. I could not even believe it.
And what struck me is when I read that part of your newsletter, it reminded me of something that Michael Hoffman wrote. He wrote Psychological Warfare and Secret Societies, I think. And he says he writes the idea of revelation method from a perspective of the British intelligence, as he says. He says about revealing some of these scandals. He says this demonstrates – this is from the standpoint of one of the, members of the secret society or a member of British intelligence is the context that he's writing. But this is what he writes. He says, this demonstrates one of our simpler methods. Realizing that our activities will sooner or later come to light, we structure our activities so that as conspiracy researchers unravel them, they will release information in such a way that it mirrors our initiatory procedure. In this way, the more we are investigated, the more the masses of people are psychologically processed by the people who seek to expose us. The meme that constitutes our structure is then successfully mimicked within the consciousness of those who investigate us. Success can then be measured precisely to the extent that our work is exposed, in quotes, in quotation marks. And so when some of these scandals occur and there's no real investigation, no punishment, no consequences for these actions, society is nevertheless exposed to the scandalous nature of what these people are doing. It gets out there, it gets talked about, just like as Bill Clinton's affair with Monica Lewinsky led to an increase in oral sex among middle school students. these scandals about pedophilia when nothing is really done about it, in a sense, sort of normalizes it. And I had this, I was thinking about this over the Christmas holiday weekend, that the issue of transgenderism came up. And one, I guess one person who was attending this holiday dinner, Christmas dinner, was talking about the North Carolina situation, and a debate started about the bathroom issue and transgenderism and how are we supposed to handle this. And I was thinking, here we are, all adults, talking about transgenderism around a bunch of kids.
Oh, wow.
When I was a kid, I never even heard of it. Yet now it's being talked about a bunch of kids, and I'm forced to debate this issue with a couple of people, or I'm drawn into a debate, and I have to talk about this subject when in the past, you know, my 14-year-old daughter never would have heard anything about such things until perhaps a little later in life she would have come across it. But it's being normalized as something that – and this is this sort of alchemical process that's going on, degradation of society.
Well, children have been exposed to so much over the last few decades and generations. I mean, even the performance of rock stars. I remember watching a Jimi Hendrix concert on television. This is, of course, we lived in Sweden, which was progressive, but it was the 1970s. And my mother came upstairs and she was just horrified because here's Hendrix and he's like thrusting his pelvis and doing these really gross things while he's playing his guitar. And of course, my brother and I were watching. We didn't really know what to think of it because we were about 12 and 13. But my mother stood there going, what is he doing? And then I think there was one scene, it's very famous, where he actually pees on his guitar or something. He sets it on fire. I don't know if that was in this bit of footage, but I remember seeing that or something like that on TV and my mother just going nuts.
Well, I mean, I've done a number of interviews and about that, about sort of this, the influence of like Aleister Crowley. Of course, a lot of musicians, rock stars worship Aleister Crowley and his connections to intelligence and connections to people like Alfred Kinsey, who was promoted by Time Life. And Alfred Kinsey, of course, was a big promoter of pedophilia through his research, you know, and his research, rather flawed research, was sort of setting the it sort of created the academic setting for the unleashing of the sexual revolution of the 1960s, and he was promoted, you know, by all the institutions and you know, whether it's Life magazine or New York Times, I came across this, you're talking about, you know, degradation, sort of this introducing these things to society. People tend to think of it as sort of linear development or societal decay that's occurring naturally. It has no real plan to it or agenda. It's just kind of happening. But in 1969, there's something called the Jaffe Memo. And it was a memo that was recorded a meeting of Planned Parenthood. In 1969, I think in Pennsylvania, Planned Parenthood was commissioned by the U.S. government to address population control. And in that meeting, they openly talked about proposing sexualizing society, sexualizing children, promoting homosexuality, promoting things like family breakup. Because if you promote family breakup, you make it easier to sexualize society because within broken families, children are much more vulnerable to abuse and trauma. And through abuse and trauma is where you get afflictions like largely where you get some people believe where homosexuality is derived. That similar program was proposed by the book The Authoritarian Personality, which was published by the American Jewish Committee, working in conjunction with the CIA. You know, promoting cultural Marxism, promoting weakening the family, weakening parental, particularly the role of the father in the family, to break apart and weaken society. So it's been a long, drawn-out plan. You know.
Well, Tim, I just want to call attention. I'm reading a book about Margaret Sanger in Planned Parenthood, and granted, it's a mainstream book, but I'm not all the way through it by any means. But I was interested to note that Sanger received many letters from women who were in these situations that were impossible for them. I don't know if you're aware, but as they were building the railroad across the country, people in the cities, population was growing so quickly that families often had one child for every year of marriage. So these women had been writing to Sanger telling her, I wish you could invent a pill to stop pregnancy because, or prevent pregnancy, because I can't be pregnant again. My husband comes home, he's drunk, and he rolls on top of me, and I'm pregnant. Boom. And then it's another child. I already have too many children. I can't keep having children. I mean, it was very difficult for these women. It takes a toll on your body. Yes, it's a natural process, and it's lovely and all of that, but it does take a huge toll on the female body to produce a child. You're making another human being. And then to have one for every year of marriage and to be, you know, poor, and this was when people left the land. They were invited, and this is by propaganda and social engineering, to quit being farmers and get to the cities where they could have a much easier job, where they didn't have to do backbreaking work out in the field starting at 4 a.m., feeding the chickens and plowing the soil. They could now work in a factory, and they could be a, you know, widget mover. And look how easy that would be. And it's indoors, and you're not going to have aches and pains. But seriously, they didn't have the land to feed their family. So their overall gain went way down, and the women were suffering. They did not know. They were beside themselves. So I thought that that was kind of interesting.
Well, yeah, the urbanization of society, and the pauperization of society. Well, it's similar to what occurred in England with the enclosure movement, which created paupers and created the surplus labor for the Industrial Revolution. Society is always going to have its problems, and but there's ways you can exploit a problem to achieve an end which isn't necessarily advertised. You know, that's the Rockefeller Foundation is good at that, where they promote things like equality, right, or women's rights, you know, and be liberated, go get a job and be liberated, as if that's liberation. And we're seeing what's happening today with that, where, you know, women are now have become wage slaves in many respects, and they don't have the benefit of a larger family, of a support system, or even extended families. One benefit of those rural communities was you had extended families, and you could have a support system. Whereas when they created the nuclear family, you were slowly cutting them off from their from their past, their lineage, their ethnic background, and they become deracinated. And they eventually became the middle class, where they, you know, once they built the highway system and moved them into the homes and the tract homes of the suburbs, they were much more easily managed to convert them into sort of these addicted consumers that we see today, but large what American society is today. So...
And the nature of living changed so much, because once the people were taken from the land, imagine how disconnected they became from sunlight and from dirt, mm-hmm. which gave you the electrons necessary to remedy that situation you mentioned earlier called oxidative stress, mm-hmm. Which is failure of the cells to produce enough energy to keep themselves going. So you can have oxidative stress to your entire body, or to certain areas or tissues or organ systems, and then you start having degeneration, cell death, potentially cancer. So when the people were taken out of the sunlight and the earth, from which they get electrons, this is called free electron transfer, and the photons of sun help to produce not just ATP in the cells, but vitamin D, which is necessary for God knows how many hundreds of biological activities that are crucial to good health. So now the people are indoors, They're living away from the sun and the land. They're working indoors. And the children are not benefiting from frolicking around on the farm and, you know, learning just by living. The children have to be educated by the school system because they can't be sent out into the city streets where they would become pickpockets and worse, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the health status of the populace goes way down. They start to develop these modern illnesses, you know, illnesses of degeneration. And that, all of that, it's just a big spiral. So it says to me that we need to be living in small communities with in contact with land and light.
Yeah.
And it, we're not doing that.
Yeah, and in a society or a community that's agrarian-based, you're going to have local markets for food. It's going to be largely outside the money economy, but that makes these societies less manageable. You can't have globalism with these independent communities, they can still trade with the communities nearby, and even get some of the benefits, you know, of the city. You know, whether that's, you know, through the Sears catalog or something. There's a balance here, I guess, but. Yeah, you're right. You're not participating in life itself, and if you look at the people who one of the problems of living in the city is you're not familiar with with how food grows, where it comes from. You're dependent on the money economy, and during the Great Depression, one silver lining of the Great Depression was that America was still largely rural and agrarian. So when the money economy collapsed, many people could get by. They made their own clothes. They repaired their own clothes. They grew their own food. So when the stock market crashed and the bank closed, they could still support themselves. You know.
Yeah, and on the land you have an abundance of food. I mean, look at a lemon tree. Look at how many lemons grow on a lemon tree, and how many lemons can one person eat, you know? And we have little gardens, we have tomatoes galore, and zucchini grows like nobody's business. And, you know, on the farms, there was always food to eat. And by the way, I want you to know that I have a friend who's an organic farmer in Colorado, and she told me this year that from her entire crop of corn, now granted, she doesn't have huge cornfields, she only was able to get 2 edible ears of corn. And that's because of the massive filtration of sun. This is the sepsis agenda, biological darkness from chemtrail cover in Colorado. Things just don't grow anymore because they get filtered sunlight. That's the equivalent of moonlight.
So I guess eventually we'll have to get all our food from Monsanto. And they're
that's right.
Drought-tolerant
seeds, renewable seeds, licensed food, genetically modified. And people will be told, look, do you want to eat or do you not want to eat? If you want to eat, then you have to eat our GMO zucchini and tomatoes and GMO everything. And the aim, this is truly satanic, is to create food out of feces and blood. For instance, they've now innovated. This is somewhere in Denmark. There's a food lab, and they've decided that it's better to bind cake batter with blood, which has coagulants in it, than to use eggs. Because using blood is more, it's less wasteful. Animal blood, this would be, but who knows, right?
Yeah, that appears satanic, I would say. And, of course, we've heard stories about, like, was it Pepsi using a fetal material in their products, and not to mention what's used in some of the cosmetic products.
Right, Belta, the cream made of American babies' foreskins. I mean, to me, Tim, this is an expansion of the activities that these high-level elites practice in secret, which are really sacred activities to them. But it's an expansion, it's an exportation of those activities so that we, unwittingly or not, are also participating. And that gives it, I guess, on some level, karmic approval, or what is the word? There's a word for it. to pass something.
More or less sort of an indulgence, so to speak, I guess.
Endorsement. Yeah. There's another word. I cannot think of it, but you know what I'm saying.
They don't have to suffer the guilt. Yeah, they think somehow.
They don't have to suffer the guilt. Because, hey, you know, these people are doing it too. They put the creams on their faces. The ladies rush to the department stores in London to buy this cream. And everybody's guzzling Pepsi. And so if these, you know, if everybody's doing it, what's wrong with we're the ones who started it?
Yeah. I heard an interesting statistic a while back regarding what America spends on carbonated soda. And what they spend on vegetables, and apparently they spend 5 times more on carbonated soda a year than they do on vegetables. And they said if you just simply reverse that, you would probably solve a lot of people's health problems.
Of course, yes. And I will say that I just got a call from someone I know who told me she has cirrhosis of the liver. She's not an alcoholic. She doesn't even drink alcohol, and she has what's called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, and this can develop due to drinking soda pop.
Yep.
So yeah, there are so many, you know, blind corners and things that today you're fine, tomorrow you suddenly have a toxic load that's insurmountable and you start collapsing. And then where do you go first? You're taken to the hospital. I mean, this particular person was vomiting and, you know, extremely ill. And it just came out of nowhere. And once you're in the hospital now, once you're admitted, they have the doctrine of parens patriae working in their favor. If you're, you know, comatose or in critical condition, then it's their obligation to care for you in the best manner possible. But if you do actually sign in to the hospital, then you have to submit yourself to their expertise, which is going to mean doing very expensive, exhaustive workups on you and treating you as they see fit, which as we know, you know, pharma drugs and their treatment for acute situations when you're in a hospital can be beneficial, but treatment for anything chronic or long-term is generally allopathic medicine does not know what it's doing, I'm sorry to say.
Yeah, because they don't take anything like nutrition into consideration or toxicities, because that would indict the entire system.
Right. They don't stop to think that the pharmaceuticals they're pushing, which are, you know, man-made chemical compounds, in some instances intended to imitate natural materials that have healed over the ages. For instance, aspirin comes from willow bark. Salicylic acid is known to relieve inflammation and pain. But anyway, these compounds that we're given in prescription form by our doctors, they all have a lethal dose. So this is a very interesting thing to look into. Investigating what lethal dose is. Lethal dose on a drug, it can say lethal dose 50, which means that 50% of the people given this drug at this dose will die. That's what lethal dose means, I believe. Have you heard of this?
Yeah, I've heard that from a couple doctors explain that to me. And
So every drug... Jennifer Daniels does a very good job of explaining this. She is a physician who lost her medical license in America. She lives in Panama. But doctors, she calls them licensed killers. The reason they have the MD and the license to practice is because they're taught how to dispense agents of death, meaning the drugs. And when she started to offer her patients, I find this very interesting, and I'll just sandwich it in. But she was concerned that she had a death rate in her practice. So along with lethal dose, you have this term death rate, which means every practicing physician is going to have some people die on him or her. It's a consequence of whatever. You could just have a patient who's very old, or the medication that they're taking doesn't agree with them, or their illness manages to conquer them in the end.
Yeah.
But somebody is going to die on a yearly basis, and your death rate is 4. That's considered good. If it's higher, then that's considered to be whatever it is. But In her case, she did not want any death rate, any positive number at all. She wanted a death rate of zero. So she started to offer her patients three options. She said, look, here's what you have. Here's my diagnosis. I believe that you could do X, Y, or Z. X is do nothing at all. She calls this the, it's related to the placebo effect. If you do nothing, you have a 33% chance of recovery. That's just a fact of human health. The second option was, these are natural methodologies. I've been reading books, and these are herbal treatments, natural treatments, so you could choose one of these. Or option number three is, this is what I was taught to recommend that you do, drugs, prescribing drugs or various kinds of other invasive treatments. So this is what my training says. This is the third option. Second option is the natural path. Third option is don't even do anything. And when she offered her patients these three choices, her death rate in her practice fell to zero.
That's when she got in trouble.
Well, she got in trouble because the hospital called her and they were saying, well, you know, we haven't had any patients hospitalized by you. You haven't sent anyone for x-rays and you haven't hospitalized any of your patients with us. And she said, well, I haven't needed to. And when I do, I will. I'll call you. I'll send them to you for x-rays. And the drug companies were calling her saying, we haven't ordered any drugs from us lately. And she said, well, I haven't needed to. And when I do, I'll call you. And so this created an investigation, and it was decided that she was unfit to practice medicine in America. In the end, I've given you the short version. But
yes, I think she was she deviated from the standard of care, as she phrases it, I think, and that they didn't like that because, it's not in their business model, I guess, to have people getting better.
But that, Tim, takes us to this Children's Bill of Rights. Number 7 on that bill is the right to appropriate quality health care. Mm-hmm. So I guess if you're a parent and you're not vaccinating your child, or you're not giving him, you know, his flu shot every year, or some such thing, then, or his Ritalin, which they would tell you he needs, then he's not getting the proper health care and he can be removed from your guardianship.
That's right. What constitutes proper health care?
Well, that's the operative term. You know,
the devil's in the details, as they say. Yeah.
Right, and they will get their bevy of experts to sit together and make a big, protocol of what is proper based on science. This is part of technocracy, this term that I am learning about, which is another giant octopus like the club. And the club and technocracy are intertwined like, you know, Siamese twins.
Yeah, the reign of experts.
Right.
Yeah, and this what goes with that is the weakening and destruction of the family, because you create atomized, weak individuals that have no sense of community or their ethnicity, their family, their pedigree. They're just they're sort of out there alone and nothing to fall back on other than the cold embrace of the state, and that's what the objective is. In all these things. And we're talking, you know, of course, we began this show talking about the club, this elite clique or inner circle, how they come to monopolize society, then how it relates to this apparent pedophile ring and child sex abuse. And of course, we're bringing up this, you know, appropriate medical care or health care for children. And we're talking about child abuse. Can anything be more abusive then the vaccine schedule being increased, what, from like 4 to 6 to like 40 or 50 injections now?
Dozens by the age of 5.
Yeah.
Dozens.
Yeah. What exactly is that producing now, as we see, you know, autistic rates skyrocket, other problems, you know, allergies skyrocket, the idea that now, you know, childhood illnesses and chronic illnesses are now normal, when they used to be unheard of. It used to be rare that you knew a kid that was chronically ill. It was just one unfortunate individual, one out of millions. And now it's chronic. It's become a huge industry. And if you look at the whole healthcare industry itself, these hospitals has become heavily financialized with bonds being issued, and they got to pay out on those bonds, and they have those bonds, you know, to keep up with those payments, you have to have customers coming in. You need sick people. So it's part of the business model. Sick people, healthy people, you know.
There's a very good book written by a doctor, Sandeep Johar, called Doctored, D-O-C-T-O-R-E-D, and he really goes into the whole business model of medicine. And it's written, you know, from his heart. He's a very intelligent man, and you just don't have the time to take care of people. They're just a number. They've got to be rotated in and out, and you have to conduct medicine as a business. And, of course, the malpractice insurance, the cost of being a doctor is very, very high. Mm-hmm. Cost of med school, and then, you know, so many of these doctors can't afford the Mercedes that they drive, and they've been given this reputation of being money hogs, but they have to because it's so expensive for them to do this stuff that they're doing, which is ultimately not even helpful.
Yeah, yeah. And this all goes back to the, you know, the creation of the MD, which is a Rockefeller project. And the Flexner Report back in the early part of the 20th century, and how they monopolized the allopathic, you know, heroic medicine became the norm, whereas other integrative medicines like homeopathic or naturopath weren't really developed properly, which maybe they could have developed and gone a lot further now if the resources had been put into them. But there's been no competition into against the allopaths because they, you know, it's illegal to compete with them.
That's right.
So, well, Sophia, we talked about a lot. I want to thank you for spending so much time with me.
You're very welcome, Tim. It's always great to do a show with you because you have a tremendous amount of knowledge. I'm always sitting here. Sometimes I put myself on mute just to let you go. But you have so many facts and figures at your fingertips, and you know so much. And I get educated deeply when I do these shows with you, which I've only done two, but I want to do more so I can learn more.
Yeah, one of these days I want to get into some of your research regarding medicine and alternative treatments and sort of the plan, how the medical industrial complex factors into this because it's all related. Maybe we'll talk about that next time.
Yes, and I'm studying microbiome now, and I have to say that I really don't do tons of research. I poke around a little bit, but I get just enough information, and then I go off and think, and then I start putting it together in interesting ways. And so I've come up with this notion of what microbiome is and what we really are able to handle in terms of microbiome.
And what you find out is that just with a little bit of knowledge, most people can avoid getting ill and have very healthy lives, happy lives, and be outside the system, which is exactly they don't want. They don't want that. They don't want people. I mean, you can't patent, you know, these things. You can't charge exorbitant prices for, you know, for just natural food and these things. And another thing is when we're told, that things like organic food natural organic food is too expensive. The processed stuff is cheaper. But if you think about it, the amount you spend eventually with medical problems because of your eating adulterated or depleted food sources and creating all the health problems, you're not saving any money in the end. You're losing money because you're having a much shorter, sicker life. And how do you quantify that? Right.
Right. But there are so many pitfalls. The pitfall in organic food. I can go into that when we talk.
Yes. Well, there's so many pitfalls in alternative research in general. And it's no exception. You're right.
There are pitfalls in the world that we must navigate by our intuition, our hearts, and a modicum of good information.
Yes.
And we must have friendships. We must have a network of people who care about us, even if it's small, and with whom we can discuss this so we can expand our understanding and get more ideas. It's very hard for people to do this in complete solitude. I have some friends who don't have anybody to talk to except me or, you know, one or two other people at most. And, you know, some people have no one to talk to because they're walled off. Their spouse and their family, they're nuts. So to all those You're not nuts. You know that. And sooner or later, you will stumble into someone who knows what you know and can share ideas with you. So don't be lonely.
Yes.
So, again, your website is sophiasmallstrom.com.
Yes, that's my URL that goes directly to my blog. And I post on my blog a few times a week. And then to the side, you'll see the tabs and you can go to the podcast page. I do a couple of podcasts a month, and I've started to put up podcast interviews that I do with others like you. But I also want to mention to people that I have a store, an online store, avatarproducts.com. And you can get to the store from my blog. Its links are there. And in that store, I share what I've discovered along the lines of body remediation. I really, since I turned 50 and started to get aches and pains and the usual stiffness, I was thinking, what is going on? Something, there's got to be some way to feel better. And so what I've got in my store is not a giant store, but it's become popular with my listeners. And if something's in there, I just want to say this. It really works. It's worked for me, and people are finding that it's working very, very well for them too. And so I urge you to visit the store, avatarproducts.com, just see what's there. Try a couple of things. Start low, you know, buy something inexpensive and just see if it works or not. And then try other things.
Great. And your newsletter is by subscription, right?
Yes. There's a little icon on the blog page, sophiasmallstrom.com. You can read some samples. It's a $50 donation per year, and foreigners, it goes out by hard copy, because I find that people who get something by email, they'll start reading it and then they get interrupted and they stop. So the hard copy newsletter goes to you in the mail, and you can, you know, cuddle up in bed with it or some such thing, have some tea or soup and read it. And I try to make it very different each month, delving into a subject that has come across my path that I explain in a way that is entertaining but informative in the best way that I can make it that.
Great. Excellent. Well, listen, Sophia, thank you. And I'll only wish you right now, today is New Year's Eve, so I'll wish you Happy New Year.
Thank you, and Happy New Year to you too.
Thank
Tim.
You. And we'll keep in touch, and I'll bid you farewell for now. And
all right.
Enjoy the nice California weather.
It's not that nice. It's slate gray sky and raining here and there. But you know what? It's still enjoyable because it's the world.
That's right. Okay. Thanks a lot.
Bye.
Bye-bye.